listening to the Bluefish Podcast with Travis and Dave.
Hello, I'm Travis.
And I'm David. We are your hosts. This is episode 6 of the Bluefish Podcast. We are glad you're here. We are liberal Southern Christians. We're here to talk news and politics. Whoever you are, we are glad you tuned in. Thanks for downloading us.
Yeah, and Dave, I don't think we can look into politics too much this week without going into a little bit the State of the Union address, kind of the big hot topic in politics, condensed it all in there for us and gave us most of the things that we need to cover.
Yeah, this has been an interesting week for politics. Of course, every week is interesting right now. So there's just too many wacky things being said, too much going on with the elections for us not to have something to talk about.
Yeah, it always gets a little intense. But what did you think of the State of the Union? Where were you at?
I thought it was good. I thought it was good in general. So specifically, I thought it was optimistic. I like that. I thought the president did a good job of explaining why the State of the Union is strong and that it is strong. I thought it was interesting. On the one hand, he did talk about compromise and about how it would be great if the party started to get along better and end this 6 or 8 years of just absolutely political gridlock and just hateful rhetoric going back and forth. It would be great to end that, but on the other hand, at the same time, he did certainly get in a few good jibes at the Republicans. Not that they don't deserve it, but you know, I thought it was interesting. You had on the one hand, hey, let's compromise, but also, by the way, here's some big complaints I've got right now.
Well, and so, I think even these statements about the compromise are kind of in their own ways, sort of a jab, because it's reminding that things had been passed. And so what happens with that is that when you remind people that, you know, some things did get done, we made a budget, regardless of if the budget was great or not. And we do tend to sort of make them in the last possible minute before we can't. But yeah, we didn't have a government shutdown this year because we couldn't agree on anything. So that was, that's a step. At least we didn't, you know, shut everything down. But we did that. We passed a trade agreement. We might not see eye to eye on military budgeting, but we passed a couple of things. And what that's doing is saying, hey, we've done this in the past, so can you provide an understanding of why it seems to be so impossible to do it when you get onto those issues that are essentially, well, they're kind of core issues, they're base issues, things that people are going to get really mad at you about.
Right. Well, one thing that I thought was a huge positive was kind of going over some of the numbers. He did kind of tout his success in job creation. So since the bottom pit, since the nadir, the lowest point, we've added, I believe, 14 million jobs. I think that's what he said in the State of the Union. And that's a big positive. I think it's getting harder and harder to sell the idea that the economy is doing poorly when, you know, last month we added, I believe it was over 250,000 jobs. And that has been a streak that's just been going on for months and months. It's a big feather in his hat. Now, how much of that is really the fault of the president is kind of debatable. I think that he has a lot of impact. Yeah, that's good. That's huge. And also GDP growth, I think, has been humming along at about 2% through his tenure. And that may not be amazing, but given that this includes the worst recession had, you know, in years and years, that's pretty amazing. So I think that there's a lot of stuff that the president can rightly crow about right now.
Yeah, and taking that victory lap is obviously a pretty important thing to do when you are at the end of your term limit, so you're going to be termed out anyway. But what it's also doing subtly, and I'm surprised that people didn't pick up on this a lot more and kind of jump on his case about it a bit, but it's essentially kind of throwing a nudge in a positive direction for the Democrat candidates for presidency. It's kind of saying, hey, you know, not just the success, but just a reminder to people, like, hey, all of these successful policies have been happening. Remember, you're going to have people talking about them. And so he's saying, if I made some positive decisions and some positive guidance. And so if I throw my support into a candidate and say, oh, well, you know, I'm in line with whatever their economic policy is, then it's kind of saying that you're approving and expecting similar results to continue based on their views.
Yes, this State of the Union is as just as important for Bernie Sanders or for a Hillary Clinton as it is for Obama, because like it or not, when the election time comes, when it's time to pull the levers, people are voting as much as anything on Obama. And we know, you know, it was the same for Bush. Obama was elected in part because everybody was so fed up with what had happened in 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
And they didn't want any more of that. So probably the Democrats could have ran a hobo fresh off a train and done pretty well, because and likewise, had Obama done more poorly than he did, then I think a Hillary Clinton or a Bernie would have a hard time.
Well, and obviously coming out of 8 years of presidency is notoriously mm-hmm. difficult to have the same political party get elected for presidency. But they are lucky in that Obama still does have a relatively favorable perception amongst the populace. So, and the people he's not favorable with, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. They're not going to vote for you one way or another. They've already decided that he is our communist overlord. So whoever he supports is just his right-hand puppet who's going to secretly get him back in so he can take over as supreme overlord, master right. ruler.
Yes, that's assuming we're lucky enough that he doesn't have a coup and decide that he's just going to stay in office for another 10 years.
Which he'll do, because you don't have enough, you don't have any more guns to prevent him.
He's going to take all your guns.
Yeah,
and
you,
then he's
you have
going
a lot
to
of
announce.
Guns. I have no guns, but you have.
He's supreme emperor for life, because he is a weak, spineless, cowardless dictator.
Yeah.
So we're told. That's what I'm told. I don't know. You know, there were a lot of predictions that Obama was going to be, you know, a huge failure in economics, that gas was going to be $5-6 a gallon, that there was going to be massive unemployment and so on. And instead, what we have is quite the opposite. Now, let's just be clear, you know, this isn't an incredible recovery. This is a slow plotting recovery.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. There's not a, you know, what this isn't, there's not a lot of reason to party just yet. There's not, there's a lot of good news, but it's just not great news. You know, unemployment's down to 5%, but we still have wages. They're still not yet recovered. Although the past year, you know, wages have increased more, as I think people realize that they have more bargaining power in an economy where the unemployment's 5%. Mm-hmm. But
and we do have several states that are passing
right.
minimum wage increase laws that will be taking effect this year and next year, as we kind of trickle those in and they sort of roll in. It's usually a multi-year process when those are occurring. But, you know, that's going to be exciting, because that's going to be a real night and day comparison, just sort of like the healthcare reform bill was when states such as those that you and I live in, Dave, in Tennessee and North Carolina, chose to fight against it and forgo any government engagement and things like that. And then you compare it to other states who embraced it and, you know, worked within the subsidy system, made the exchanges. And I still see it night and day in the various medical institutions that I've worked in, that we are so far behind in our states than those who embraced the policies that have been put in place. And I think we'll start to see those with some of these upcoming changes that have happened. And we're going to see that also in broader spectrums as well, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement that has gone through.
OMG.
Yeah. We're going to start seeing the results of that. That's going to start to become evident here soon. The work with Iran is, I think, already become evident. So.
Right. Yeah. He's got a strong legacy, and it's only going to get stronger after his presidency, once the full scope of the effects of these policies kind of play out. Again, there's plenty of reason to be pessimistic about certain problems. I think terrorism is going to stay with us. We will eventually wipe out ISIS. We're going to render them nearly irrelevant, just as Al-Qaeda is nearly irrelevant. And then, of course, someone else will pop up in their place. The Middle East is not going to stabilize itself. We're not going to be able to stabilize it. There's going to continue to be problems there, and whoever is in charge is always going to get blamed for that, which I think is silly. The Middle East is a mess. There's little that we can do and very little that we should do to try to sort that out.
Speaking of the Middle East, Dave, as our podcast resident military expert, which is basically between you and I.
I know stuff about tanks.
I have not driven a tank. You have ample more experience driving a tank than I do.
Right.
I thought that one of the interesting things about the State of the Union, as empowering and invigorating as it was pretty heavy-handed with the rah-rah military rhetoric.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I have mixed feelings about that. Number one, I absolutely think we need to have a strong military, and we need to be ready for anything, and we need to also take care of our troops and make sure their salaries are commensurate with the risk and the suffering that that job can often entail. But at the same time, I am always uncomfortable when we go into a period where, like we have now, where jingoism is like this. There's people beating drums all the time to get boots on the ground and to carpet bomb various Middle Eastern countries. Oh, it's just like that. There was a survey where I think it was 20-something percent of the Republican Party said that they would like to bomb the Aladdin's home country. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so and that's just a... And it's just a made-up country, and you know, people are like, yeah, we definitely need to bomb that.
Agrabah.
Agrabah, yes. We want to bomb Agrabah. I say, what have the good people of Agrabah done to you, Republicans, to deserve your wrath, that 20-some-odd percent of you want to bomb Agrabah?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but they are very heavy-handed with corporal punishment. They tried to kill Aladdin for stealing an apple.
Now, that is absolutely, which, you know, we can talk about mandatory minimums and overly harsh judicial systems all day long. But yes, that was atrocious, and maybe we should at least consider sanctions against Agrabah. But I don't think we should bomb them.
I'm in favor of it. I think Jafar is just getting really out of hand, and we need to stamp down on him.
Agree to disagree. Agree to disagree. You know, Jafar is, at least you could say this, Jafar is strong. He is a strong leader.
Yes.
Yes, he and Putin, I mean, I bet they could both just ride around on a bear naked and kick butt. Yeah. So I think, we need to stand behind our military. We need to keep it strong. But we also need to use it only when we have to. We can't be rushing into wars. And here's another thing. All this talk, all this like saber rattling and talking about carpet bombing, that is not what you do when you're in a position of strength. That is what you do when you're in a position of weakness. And a strong country will go in and solve the problems with negotiation. We know, and all the various Middle Eastern countries terrorist organizations that we're dealing with that are often in opposition to us, they don't have any misunderstanding about our military might. They know that we're the most powerful military in the world. They know that we have nuclear weapons. Russia knows that our military is vastly overpowering compared to theirs, especially, again, as you pointed out when you and I were on the phone the other day, when you take into account our allies. We have very powerful allies as well. The United States and its allies make up more than 60% of all the military spending in the world. There's no enemy that we can't take on. So why do we need to dump our chests and stomp around like a gorilla trying to frighten people? It's just not necessary. people know we're strong. We've got the power to deal with anything that we decide to deal with. And again, I think that it just shows weakness and cowardice if you are one of those people who just like to rattle a saber and talk about how we should turn other nations into glass parking lots and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think that, my opinion is if a politician is going to vote in favor of these things, they need to be very involved in them. And in that sense, I respect the decisions when commander in chiefs do decide to make those decisions. I mean, they're the ones who have to sign the letters that go out to family members that say, hey, here's what happened, and your father, son, wife, whatever, is not coming home. They have to sign them. They have to read them, put them out, take some accountability for those faces that came from the decisions that they made. So it's a pretty heavy-handed thing, but I think that I have a little bit less of a, I'm a little less of a fan when it's just Congress people sitting around making these broad statements and saying, oh, we should go do this and we should go do that. But, unless you're going to get really affected by it.
However strong your talk is, however tough your talk is, that doesn't mean anything to me if you're not the one wearing combat boots. Yeah. Anybody can go up there and thump their chest and slam their fist down on a podium and talk about what we can do and what we're going to do. But if you're not the one that is actually going to go down to the two-way range, that doesn't increase my respect for you, because what have you got? You have no skin in the game. You're going to continue to be a rich congressman tomorrow. That's what you are today. So, to the folks out there who are using that kind of talk, Ted Cruz, for example, and of course, Donald Trump, I'm not super impressed by that. That's, you're not the one that's going to be, you're not the one that actually has to deal with the problem once troops get deployed.
Yeah. And that's, that's one of the reasons I'm a fan of the way that the British have often handled it, where the royal family members actually have to serve in positions of service within the military system and things like that. To be like, hey, look, if you make a decision, somebody important to you has to go in. So, if it's worth it, then it's worth it. That is what it is, but just it shows that there's a little bit of a level of congruency there.
Yeah. I could care less about the British royal family. But for the, Prince William and Prince Henry, who have both served in some capacity, tremendous respect for that. I could care less about their fancy coat and fancy boots that they get for being a prince. But I am very respectful and appreciative that they did serve.
Outside of the military stuff, though, I thought that it was inspiring, and I think that it'll hit some notes, and it does dispel the statements that people try to make about President Obama being weak on different issues. I get ridiculously tired of hearing these statements that the president or that Democrats are anti-military, and that they are weak on terrorism, and that they don't care about these things happening. Because, honestly, the things that have happened under Democrat leadership is basically kind of in line with whatever was going on before. So,
right now, I think that we're going to continue to have terrorism no matter who's president. I don't know how much control we really have over that. What we can do is what we've, and this is more or less what the president articulated, continue to do airstrikes, continue to do targeted strikes against the leadership of ISIS, weaken them, take care of their funding, which we've done a pretty good job of keeping them from exporting their oil in the ISIS-controlled territories. But we are still always going to – here's what is I wish people would understand. We are going to continue to have terrorist attacks in the United States indefinitely, maybe for 100 years, maybe for 1,000 years. That's never going to change. Terrorism is as old as humanity, probably. And who's president is not going to change that. You know, you can blame it on anybody you want, but it's still going to be there. Now we can mitigate it a little bit, and we can, if you eliminate the leadership that plans and funds major operations like the 9/11 bombing, then that can have a big impact. But what you can never really effectively do is clamp down on individual actors or small groups or very low cost operations in the United States or anywhere else. It's just, I don't know how you completely eliminate the possibility of that. I don't think you can.
Yeah, I mean, all it takes is a level of conviction of something mm-hmm. that yes. overrides your rationale thinking or drives you to extreme decision making.
Yeah, but and there's the other question is, have we been effective at what we can do? And I think the answer to that is absolutely we have. And we did eliminate Osama bin Laden. I believe we've killed like six more of the people who were hoping to be successors of Osama bin Laden. And we've eliminated a lot of high level, high profile, terrorist personalities, and that's great. And again, we've also done a lot of, it's 5,000 plus, it was, you know, within the thousands, how many airstrikes we've done over the last 6 or 7 years, to take out various targets. And it's been pretty effective. And there's evidence now that ISIS is beginning to struggle both with funding and holding territory. And all those are positive. It is going to be a long battle. It's going to continue to go on for years. And then again, as soon as we've eliminated ISIS, something else will pop up somewhere. This doesn't end. We can only keep doing what we're doing, you know? And yeah. if we could send troops over there. And I guarantee you, if we send 150,000 soldiers and Marines to Syria and Iraq to control ISIS, we could more or less contain the situation. But it's going to continue to cost us hundreds of billions of dollars per year. We're going to lose hundreds of soldiers per year, just like we did from, you know, 2003 on up, you know, in Iraq. And it's just going to keep going and going. So I think that we're on the right path. It's just not going to be a pretty, it's the worst, it's the best of a bunch of terrible options. There's not a lot of great options with how to deal with Middle East terrorism. But this is the least awful.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's one of the things that he was also pretty vocal about was that, you know, if things happen to us, obviously we have to respond in accordance to that, and we have to look after ourselves. But we also don't need to make sure that we don't get stuck into that trap of becoming the world police every time that we see a situation that mm-hmm. we feel impassioned about, that we don't automatically jump on in and get ourselves kind of mixed up in situations that either we may make it worse or we don't properly understand yet.
Right.
Or we commit ourselves to some kind of a thing that, okay, well, great. Now we're trying to stay here and stabilize this place that hasn't been stable for decades. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I agree. I think like any effective future strategy is going to absolutely require creating some new system where we incentivize all the Middle Eastern players over there, Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Turkey, to all get on board to organize the solution and to commit troops and money so that we're not the only ones over there anymore. These are largely Arab problems. They need Arab solutions. And while we can be part of that, we can't do it on our own anymore. It's absurd.
And we could also do it in more diplomatic ways, which I think is also one of the amazing stories about that situation. Oh, yeah. Is obviously before the State of the Union, during the pre-coverage, they were talking about the captured sailors by Iran.
Right.
And by the next day, it was confirmed that they were released and returned. So I thought that was, you know, pretty impressive. And it didn't become a situation where it jeopardized the things that had been set up and put in place. Iran continued to comply with their removal of necessary components that we requested of them, and kept moving on.
Absolutely. And people don't seem to realize how badly that could have gone.
Oh, absolutely.
We had two military vessels, which apparently, as far as we know, seem to have drifted into Iranian waters, into their territorial waters, and there's, you know, there
super
could
shifty.
Easily, yeah, there could have easily been a armed conflict there. They could have sunk those little ships. They were very tiny little boats. They could have sunk those and had a plausible reason for doing so. Yes, it probably would have scuttled the agreement, and yes, it would have resulted in the being continued. But they didn't do that, and I don't know that that would have been the case had we not had this agreement in the cards on deck. They may have just sunk these ships and claimed it as a big victory against the United States. Yeah. It is also a testament, perhaps, to how maybe they are afraid of the United States, just as you know a lot of the chest-thumping folks have suggested they need to be. I think that they're already afraid of the United States, and I do think that you know that's evident by the fact that, again, they didn't sink and kill these sailors.
Well, or if this had happened a few years ago, what they probably would have done was just kept the sailors, and they would have been there for
freaking
weeks
10 years,
or months, or years, or until we provided them with some kind of a egregious sort of a transfer and transition, and it didn't happen. They took them, they gave them back the next day.
I think there's one other angle to this, which is, this is a particularly weak point for Iran in terms of the agreement, the sanctions, and the negotiations, because they've already turned over 98% of their nuclear material, as they were required to do by the agreement. So if now is the worst time, now that they've complied with their end of the bargain and we have not yet lifted the sanctions, that would be a terrible time to start trouble, because they've just given up most of their leverage, or a good part of their leverage, because they can always still make more. But I mean, that would definitely set them back quite a bit to lose that amount of nuclear material. So perhaps they realize that, and it's fascinating, though. It's fascinating how much all that goes into it, and it did turn out to be a diplomatic solution. Things ended happily. So another feather in the cap of Secretary Kerry and Obama as well.
Yeah, overall, pretty impressive. And then just the other day, we had another exchange of individuals, which kind of, I saw some blowback from a couple of the Republican candidate front runners of, you know, we exchanged seven people for four, whatever. Uh-huh. You know, at the end of the day, they had four people, and we got four people out, and they didn't have seven people.
Yeah.
Negotiating for seven people, they didn't have it.
I have only read a little bit about that prisoner transfer. I know that I think one of the guys that was going to be exchanged was a former Marine, and I think there was a pastor over there. So
he's a missionary.
I don't really care how many prisoners we trade to get prisoners. Number one, there's nothing wrong with trading prisoners for prisoners. That's totally not unusual. Number two, there's nothing that says that it has to be an even number of individuals for an even number of individuals. That has never been the case in the history of prisoner transferring. And, you know, it's just, I think trading therefore in our seven that we had, either way, now however many you trade, it's just an example of showing some good faith, trying to advance relations. There could be a lot of other angles to it. Again, we really want this nuclear deal to work. It buys us 10 years plus, maybe more, to figure out what happens next. Maybe, you know, a lot of people think it's going to buy Iran 10 years to build up, and that may be the case. But who's to say that in 10 years we won't have some better bunker busters that can better deal with their hidden reactors, and maybe better satellite technology to detect that kind of activity. So I'm not particularly worried about that. I think that if, you know, I think that the agreement is good. I think that this prisoner transfer and the sailors being released are more evidence that things are working. And by the way, I don't think that it's necessarily a foregone conclusion that Iran is not going to be a valuable partner for the U.S. 10 or 20 years from now.
Yeah, if you look at the state of Iran, I mean, Iran is not one of those countries that's constantly in a state of turmoil and all sorts of things. Now, granted, we don't agree with a lot of their policies, and they side with people that are oftentimes enemies of us. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. They're not not people that we're going to, you know, have over for the barbecue or something like that in our backyard. But at the same time, if you open up the door for engagement, it's not, if we're on good diplomatic terms, it's not unsafe for Americans to go over there. And I think we've shown in a lot of different places, and we're starting to see that in Cuba, and we've seen it in places like Saudi Arabia or the UAE or things like that, that, you know, when you open up those ties, open up that exchange of culture and commerce, it really weakens the hold that extremism has and those views that lead people to go toward extremist viewpoints, because extremism functions most effectively when you have isolation, when you're able to be in a bubble, only people that have your views and only share your views and things like that. But once you bring diversity into a situation, extremism tends to die down in a lot of situations.
Yeah, I agree. I think Iran is a very fascinating and relatively developed country in the Middle East. Tehran is full of moderates and well-educated young people, people that are wanting more, people that want more change, people that are pushing for more change. It's interesting that some of their political dynamics are very similar to ours. Most of the hardliners are going to be country people. They are living out in the more agricultural and, you know, far out, far flung areas of Iran, rural areas, if you will. And then you're more moderate and westernized in a lot of cases, even folks are going to live in Tehran and the other big cities. So, and a lot of people in Tehran actually love America, and a lot of them have ties to America. There are lots of Iranians living in America and other Western nations. So, there's room for change. I think that especially if we make some gradual thawing and positive overtures, and so long as we continue to get good response from the hardliners, I think we can make this work. And I think that there is every reason to hope that in 10 or 20 years, America and Iran will be able to play ball together. It may not necessarily work out, but if it does not work out, we always have military options to fall back on. I'm hopeful.
Yeah. And I think that the overall theme of the State of the Union address as a whole was one of hopefulness, one of optimism.
It was.
Closing of the State of the Union, I thought, was just invigorating and powerful. And clarifying that we live in an amazing time, amazing things are happening.
Hey, what did you think of the cancer moonshot and picking out Joe Biden to kind of chair the effort to cure cancer?
I thought that was, I felt like that was a little bit left field. I didn't know exactly where he was coming from. I mean, Joe Biden's been pretty clear that he's not planning to run. I kind of think that was almost like a softball lob to Bernie or Hillary to see if either of them wanted to pick it up and run with it, to have just an issue that they want to, you know, keep in their pocket, maybe not be their primary issue, but one of their auxiliary goals is, hey, you know, on the side, I'm doing this, and, you know, that, you know, may bring some independents or moderates over to their side if that's something they're passionate about. Obviously, it's a topic that has touched the lives of everyone.
I actually believe that this was something that he just feels from his heart is something we can do. I feel like Joe Biden is a natural choice to kind of put as a figurehead on it, because of course Joe lost Beau, his son, just a few months ago, and to cancer, of course. And so he's the natural choice to put in that position. I think it was a nice gesture to Joe. I feel like this is something that someone has needed to do for a long time. I doubt it will work, at least not maybe in the way, not in a dramatic, sudden way. But what I would love to see is a renewal of, like, America's commitment to medical research and some gradual change, some gradual investment in cancer treatment so that we can eventually cure it. Maybe this is going to be a part of that. I hope so.
Well, I think the thing to realize, and that was also another thing of his optimism and his overall view of the possibilities that America has at its fingertips and the resources that we have and the great and amazing people that we have here when we bring together ourselves in cohesion as opposed to in opposition to one another and in conflict with one another. But when we unite on a cause, we do amazing things. I mean, I don't doubt that when people were thinking of the concept of putting a person on the moon, when that's never happened, when we haven't even been in space yet, the idea of like, oh yeah, well, we're going to do within 10 years, we're going to put somebody on the moon. Like, what the heck? You know, science fiction. But that's the amazing thing about this nation is that when you put our focus and our resources onto something, there's no reason that we can't do it no matter what it is. I think if somebody said like, if the nation was somehow rallied around the idea of, I don't know, teleportation, I don't know, whatever, you know, oh, we're going to make a teleporter. Okay. You know, probably we could do that. Probably we could.
So that'd be awesome.
Yeah. So if the goal is to make, to find a cure for cancer or at least some of the forms of cancer or something like that, I don't think there's any reason that that's out of the realm of possibility, but it only works if we are united and impassioned on the topic as a whole. We can't be half in, half out.
So would you get in it? If they make a teleporter, are you going to get in it?
I wouldn't get in it. I don't think I would.
I'm concerned that it basically destroys you and then makes a copy of you somewhere else.
That's my main concern is I read, did you ever read Timeline by Michael Crichton?
No, I did not.
Did you see the terrible movie Timeline based on the book that had Heath Ledger in it?
No, I didn't see that either.
And you didn't miss anything. Book was pretty good.
But anyway, I saw Hot Tub Time Machine.
Yeah, I think I did. I think I'm blocking that out of my mind. I don't think we should base our facts on Hot Tub Time Machine. But yeah, that was kind of how they pushed that in that thing, as well as it broke you down to like a level of like a data level, a molecular level, and then puts you back together. And yeah, that was kind of my thought is if I get ripped apart at a molecular level and put back together and then sort of restarted, am I still me or did I actually die? And then
I think you died and someone built a copy of you and you're not going to convince me otherwise.
Yeah.
I would have to be really clear. I'd have to really see the science. If you're beaming my electrons one by one and reassembling them, that might even, I'm still not convinced that isn't like effectively killing you and then creating a new exactly identical organism somewhere else. But yeah, still, I'm not convinced. I'm not getting in that thing. No, sir. I changed my mind. I thought maybe I would, but so, on cancer, I think this is an easy sell to the American people if this is something we really want to do. If I went door to door and I said, hey, America, would you let me increase your tax by 1% and every penny of that is going to go to various public funding projects, universities and whatnot to work on a cure for cancer and treatments for cancer, is that okay? I think most Americans have lost someone to cancer. They realize how serious and how important it is to fix this. And I think most people are on board with it. I think this is an easy sell. I think that if another candidate wants to take up the mantle of cancer research as the next moonshot, that would be, I think, a slam dunk of victory.
I think I'm hesitant. And the only reason is this, is that you have, in our country, anytime you do something with a medical system, you have too many competing interests. So when we went to the moon, you had NASA. You had a federal program. There was one program. There was one group of people interested in it. So everything was funneled in one direction. Curing cancer, you've got a lot of players in that game. Mm-hmm. Every pharmaceutical company dreams, their stockholders dream of being that company that comes up with that drug. It's gold. So you've got Pfizer's doing their research in this direction or whoever, and you know, people are researching in different directions. The different cancer foundations are researching in different directions. The schools of medicine are doing different stuff. So that's the main thing. I think the main concern, I think, on my
okay.
end.
But... So, back to the State of the Union, you know, we've got the cancer moonshot. He talked about how we're doing with ISIS. He talked about climate change, about how it's time for the United States to get on board with that, and it's time for the skeptics to give it up. And of course, he said that he regretted that things had become so divisive over the past 6 or 7 years. So did we leave anything out there? That's a pretty good, that was a pretty good speech. I thought it hit all the right notes. Is there anything else you would have said?
No, I think overall I'm kind of a fan of it.
I liked it.
I mean, it's the final State of the Union. It's always a hard thing to do. You've kind of got to balance that.
So now, scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the State of the Union on the whole? The speech, not the actual State of the Union.
I'd give it an 8.
Yeah, me too.
It's okay. I mean, it could have been a lot better. There was some agenda stuff in there, and obviously mm-hmm. that kind of needs to be there. It's going to be one of the most covered things that the president's going to have. It's his biggest speech of the year, unless right. we have some kind of a national tragedy or something like that, where mm-hmm. it draws everyone into a moment. But other than that, it's your biggest, it's your Super Bowl of your presidency every year.
Yeah. Oh, I just found a poll on NBC. They called a bunch of people up and asked them if they watched the State of the Union and what they thought of it. And looks like 55% of the people who tuned in felt positive about his remarks. And it will come as no surprise that only 15% of Republicans felt positive about his remarks, because they did break it down by party. Just goes to show you, can't please everybody.
Nope, I like it. But overall, I think the State of the Union, like I said, pretty solid. What were your thoughts on the Republican response to the State of the Union?
Yes. So normally, I think that's kind of a train wreck usually. Normally, the last few years, it seems that you get a response from someone who's sweaty and uncomfortable and making kind of staccato, stilted remarks about, actually, oftentimes it doesn't even directly address a lot of what the president says, which is understandable because, you know, they don't know what he's going to say and they still right. have to respond to it. They kind of get the gist sometimes about what he's going to say. But anyway, so I thought Nikki Haley did great. She was a little bit plastic, a little bit bland, but she didn't make any missteps. She wasn't terribly sweaty. She didn't desperately grab for a glass of water to drink or anything like that. But at the same time, oh, and I did appreciate that she got a couple of jabs in on the Trump crowd. So overall, you know, I thought it was okay. It wasn't particularly interesting. I kind of glassed over about halfway through because, again, she was a little bland. She wasn't particularly energetic, as Trump would say. So I think that she failed as far as keeping it interesting, but she didn't make any terrible mistakes. What did you think?
Yeah, definitely not a lot of emotion.
Right.
I think with the State of the Union itself, the president's speech, you definitely got to see a lot of his emotion, especially in the closing remarks.
Sure.
You could tell when he had something he was impassioned about, you could really tell in his speech. It gets really noticeable. He's a very animated individual, not very animated, but he's an animated individual. He moves around a little bit, has some emotion. Good public speaker, which Nikki Haley admitted that he's a great public speaker, even though she felt that he doesn't follow mm-hmm. through on any of his statements. But I thought that, yeah, she could have done probably a lot better with that, just being more natural.
I think definitely.
The message overall was pretty okay, although I don't know exactly what was going on because I didn't hear a lot of concrete things. It was mostly just seeming to be a, hey, we're making a response, but we're trying to make it seem like we're not overly offensive. So we're not trying to come off overly partisan or anything like that, which was settled the subsequent day when Paul Ryan noted his response, which was just to kind of lambast everything that was going on and speak pretty negatively about a lot of stuff. But, you know, Nikki Haley's response was pretty good. And just to check, I didn't miss it, right? Are we done doing the Tea Party responses after the Republican?
I hope so.
Are we done with that now? We don't have the...
Well, you know why? That's because the Republican Party is the Tea Party now. I mean, I think that the assimilation is complete. I think that with Trump, we have evidence that the Republican Party has been hijacked by the Tea Party, and the takeover is finished. The coup has been executed, and now the Tea Party is in charge.
Yeah, and the rest of the people who miss the Tea Party so desperately are just Trump supporters.
I guess so. I mean, the Tea Party has. I thought that for a while that things were just going to get completely out of control, but instead, what seems to have happened is the whole party has just been dragged to the right. So, I still think that there's a kernel of establishment country club Republicans who are very afraid of this movement and who are very concerned that the extremism which the Tea Party brings is going to drive the whole party down into a rabbit hole. And that I think that that's well-founded fear. But at the same time, I think for the most part, people have continued to chase these Tea Party guys further and further right, you know, with the coverage on Fox News and the other right-wing kind of publications, your Breitbarts and Drudges and so forth, have all kind of just fed into this loop where it just gets more and more extreme.
Yeah. Speaking of positive rhetoric, though, so just to see how it would go, I decided to watch the State of the Union on Fox.
Oh, wow.
Not Fox News, mind you, but just, you know, network Fox. They spoke very favorably of the president. Very favorable. No. Yeah, I was surprised. Now, like I said, I wasn't watching the Fox News coverage of it, which may have been different, but the actual actual network Fox, yeah, pretty good.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah,
they also have all better camera angles going on than NBC. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I hate a bad camera angle.
Yep.
Well, what did you think about the her bringing in the Confederate flag? I thought that was. I think that again, this is kind of symptomatic of the conflict within the party, where, on the one hand, you have to accept that a small chunk of the Republican Party is just flat out racist. You know, just the other day, one of the Nazi groups endorsed Donald Trump. Which he disavowed but he followed that up with an apology for the statement, basically saying that he understood why people were afraid, blah, 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 which I feel like that's almost excusing the existence of National Socialists. So anyways, she brought in this topic of how she brought down the Confederate flag in South Carolina, in her home state, even though she has to know that there is a big chunk of her base that's not going to be thrilled with that decision. And then again, she kind of made a jab at Trump. So she was, I think, one of the front runners to be a vice president. And yet she's kind of closed a couple of doors, it seems to me, so that maybe she's a little less likely to get chosen as a vice president. If Trump doesn't win, maybe she can still be chosen.
Yeah, I think that she definitely was trying to show that they were to speak to the independents who may be concerned that the Republican Party was leaning too extreme with some of the rhetoric, and to show that there can be a more closer to moderate and hospitable and tolerant portion of the Republican Party available as well, because I think that the loud voices of anger and racism and things like that and intolerance, they get a lot of airplay. They really do. And it's definitely, you know, it's definitely not the majority of the Republican Party that feels that way, but sometimes the smallest voices are loud. And when you hear them enough, it sounds like they are the only voices. I think that she didn't do a great job of invigorating people, though. That's what I would have liked to have seen, was a real impassioned, motivating call to action.
Right. None of that.
To say, much of that. You know, hey, we are not going to stand for the strong rhetoric, and we're going to do better, and we're going to take the high road, and we're going to do these things, and we're going to make a big change, and so much is going to happen. And yeah, I get it. You've only got like 15 minutes to do this speech in, but at the same time, it's a very important 15 minutes, and I would have liked to have seen some more invigorating stuff, because you are really speaking to in these particular State of the Union responses, you're speaking to voters.
Yeah, I would like to hear some more specifics from her, and for that matter, I'd like to hear a lot more specifics from anyone that's running about what's the course they intend to plot. And for example, one thing that we have heard of is a lot of tax plans, some of which on the Republican side appear to be 8, 10, 12, 20 billion or $20 trillion, you know, in price tag over the long run. How are they going to pay for that? What are you going to cut spending wise to make that work? I'd like to hear more about what their specific plan is on terrorism. How do they stop? What's the 10-year plan? Not just let's put boots on the ground now. Let's carpet bomb now. Tell me, are we going to try to prop that government up? If so, what's the price tag for that?
Yeah.
What about their neighbors? How are we going to make sure they stay stable? And that's what we never get. And that's what we need to make an informed decision. If one were going to actually vote for one of those folks.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing that I didn't like, though, she did double down in some ways and saying there's some kind of language that is kind of doubling down on the idea that it's going to be the end of the world because ISIS exists and we're living in unprecedented danger and so forth, which is just not true. ISIS is terrible. They are dangerous, but it is, as the president said, not an existential threat. And this continuing to beat the drum and make people afraid and to just live in this world of fear, that's what ISIS wants. It's also not necessary. We just need to go about our lives, do everything we can to kill their leadership, and not give in to this idea that we need to continue to just be living our lives in fear.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a lot of potential, a lot of room for growth, and I think that the State of the Union to me feels pretty good. I feel pretty decent about it.
Yeah.
I think that the speech captured it well, that we're doing pretty well. We got a lot of room to go, and we could be doing a lot better if we'd get our ducks in a row and work at it a little bit harder. Nonetheless, we're managing. So.
Yes, and I think we can get into some of that again in our next podcast, which we've already got planned. We're going to be talking about Trump and his trucker hat, which says, let's make America great again. We're going to talk about whether or not America is already great. What does he mean by that? Get into the thick of that mess.
Yep.
So I think there's a lot there.
But if you have any thoughts on that concept you'd like us to look into for next week, shoot us an email, as always, with any thoughts on that or on this week's issue.
Oh.
With bluefishpodcast@gmail.com. And
right. What about our question for the week? So here's, I think, what would be a good question for our listeners. Let us know, send us an email and let us know, who is the strongest world leader, Obama, Putin, or Jafar from the great state of what nation does he lead again?
Agrabah.
Yes. Yeah. So, Obama, Putin, or Jafar, who is strongest? Who's the most charismatic? Who would win in a fight? Let us know what you think. I know what I think.
And then I'd like to point out, for fairness sake, that this is Aladdin 1 Jafar, not Aladdin 2 Jafar, where he was a genie. So that obviously
very important to make that distinction.
Kind of unfair. A little bit of an unfair advantage.
Yes.
So keep in mind, think level 1 Jafar. So you're still a sorcerer of great power with a talking parrot, but not an all-powerful demigod thing.
Right.
Just something to go.
Glad you brought that up. So email us at bluefishpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, and thanks again to Ronald Jenkins for giving us some music for the show. That's all we've got for this week, and tune in with us next week. I'm Travis.
And I'm David.
And this is the Bluefish Podcast. Thanks so much. Have a great night.